After the disappointment of the men's Ashes, surely men's Test cricket can only get better from here for England. Sportsbreak.com are offering a once-in-a-lifetime cricketing experience. They're supplying packages to Barbados, one of the bucket list cricket events that is England on tour in the Caribbean. Sportsbreaks.com are offering personalised ticket, travel and hotel packages around the Barbados Test match from the 16th to 20th of March this year. That includes 10 nights in one of their hand-picked hotels, with breakfast included from the 13th of March, return flights to Barbados from Manchester or London Heathrow, including all taxes, charges and 23 kilos of hold luggage allowance, a five-day standard ticket for the Kensington Oval, airport transfers by coach, transfers to and from the stadium, and with sportsbreaks.com, if the event is cancelled or moved to an alternative date, you will receive a full refund. To book your package or to find out more, head to sportsbreaks.com. All the info will be in the description as usual. Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got loads to get through today. We'll be talking about the start of England's T20I series in the Caribbean, the rain-affected women's Ashes, the extraordinary statement released this morning by Zimbabwe's Brendan Taylor, the South Africa India ODI series, and more. We'll also spend a section of the show living out our collective fantasy by pretending to be England selectors for the upcoming Test Tour of the Caribbean. And we also have an interview with the author Duncan Stone about his new book, Different Class, The Untold Story of English Cricket. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me this morning is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Let's kick things off by going straight to Mark Butcher, who's out there in Barbados to talk about the opening T20Is between England and West Indies. It's 1-1 after two games. England were thrashed in the opener and won the second by one run after a world record ninth wicket stand between Akhil Hussain and Romario Shepherd got the hosts very, very close indeed. But you're out there in Barbados at the moment. England were bowled out for 103 in that first game. Is that just one of those things that happens every now and then in T20 cricket, particularly when you've not had that much preparation?
I mean, I suppose preparation-wise, England were actually quite happy with how things had gone for them. They had that warm-up match. Jason Roy made the 36 ball 100, and you know, I think they were pretty happy going into the game in terms of their warm-ups. They just came across a surface that was tricky, to say the very least. And you know, very much in the way that England go about their T20 cricket, they kind of, you know, it was kind of, they just kept banging away, didn't they? Rather than sort of go, okay, well, this surface is not going to allow us to go along at 9, 10, 11 runs and over. They tried to force that and fell comfortably short of what a par score might have been on that surface, which I think was probably about 130 to 140. And they admitted as much afterwards. It was, you know, it was a bit of a disappointment, I suppose, given that the white ball team was supposed to make everybody feel much better after the Ashes collapses, and then they went and did the same thing themselves in the first game. But, it's a five-match series. You've got time to get back into it. But there was a lesson there, wasn't there, for tournament play? And I think Owen Morgan alluded to as much in the post-match interview that, you know, you're gonna lose tosses, you're going to end up batting first when you'd rather bowl. You're going to come up on surfaces that aren't great, and they've got to find a way of being able to make enough runs batting first in those circumstances to give the bowlers a chance in the defence. And to be fair to them, they did that much better in game two.
Why do you think that sides like England have such a preference for chasing? You get the sense that they're not that comfortable setting a total. They sometimes don't really know what a good total is.
Yeah, well, I think that goes for most teams, doesn't it? Now, you know, in the old days, in the beginning of T20, and certainly in longer form limited overs cricket, run, the old adage of runs on the board and, you know, apply pressure in the run chase was gospel. But that's been flipped on its head for quite some time now. I know that there are people more statistically minded that will be able to, tell us exactly why that is. I think that there is a fear that you're never going to get enough batting first, whereas batting second, you kind of go, well, if we need to go at 12s, then so be it. You know, the modern player and the modern way of thinking is much more geared towards being able to chase anything down and not really having that much of an idea how many is enough batting first.
Is it anything to do with conditions, do you think, just in terms of it's just slightly harder to bowl with the wet ball, particularly in day-night games? Or I know during the T20 World Cup, people were talking about pitches becoming slightly easier to bat as the dew came down, as a bit more pace in the wicket. Especially yesterday, it was a little bit too paced in the first innings and it looked like it was slightly easier to bat in the second. Owen Morgan, I think, alluded to that when he talked to you at the end of the game.
Yeah, I think that's without a doubt. You know, you start later on in the afternoon, particularly in hot countries. You know, the pitches, they start just the ball just grips a little bit more batting first, and then that that element disappears when there's a little bit of moisture around later. You know, you add to that, the ball goes into the outfield, gets a little bit wet. You know, just things become much harder to control in that second half. And you know, in some parts of the world, that's worse than others. But that's certainly, yeah, I mean, you make a valid point. That's certainly part of it. And, you know, I don't know. It seems a little bit unfair, doesn't it? You're kind of deciding World Cups and you're deciding tournaments based on conditions that are very different from one side of the game to the next. It doesn't seem to be right. What the solution to that is, however, I have no idea.
Well, one other thing on conditions, I guess. I must admit, I didn't really enjoy a lot of yesterday's game just because of how much the game was dictated by the ground's dimensions. Like, it's just not quite as fun when bowlers are just hiding the ball miles outside off stump and batters are shuffling so far across every single ball. It's just almost too repetitive. You like watching T20 cricket because you're not quite sure what the bowler's going to do. But when you kind of have an idea what they're going to do every single ball, it's not quite as fun to watch.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, I'm not entirely sure what the... what the solution is to that particular problem. You know, they moved what, two pitches to the left of the first game on Saturday. And in doing so, you end up with a very, very short boundary on one side. The bigger factor, I think, possibly was not so much the boundary dimensions, but the way the wind was. I went a bit nuts about Chris Jordan's 6-over extra cover yesterday because, I mean, seriously, The boundary was, what, I don't know, 90 yards out to extra cover the way he was hitting it. But he was also hitting it into this howling wind that was straight into. It was an extraordinary strike. That wind had dropped a little bit by sort of, you know, later on in the evening. So it wasn't quite such a big ask to hit it for six in that direction. But certainly in the first innings when England were batting, it was, you know, they tried to hit everything to the other side of the ground. And again, I think if they were really, really harsh on themselves, they got to 171. They said the pitch was a little bit tricky. It was a hell of a lot better than the one the day before, and they still made 171. And they also had the issue with the short side and the wind and all the rest of it. And if they were really harsh on themselves, they'd go, you know what, we got so preoccupied with trying to hit it to the short side that we missed out on a lot of, you know, nudge it into the long side. The West Indies were fielding right back on the fence. You know, they could have run the ball around a little bit more, you know, treat it a little bit more like a game at the MCG on one side of the pitch where you're always going to get twos. You might even get the odd three. And that 171 might have ended up being 185. And then, you know, as it was enough because, you know, even though the margin was only one run in the end, knowing that you couldn't lose in the last whatever three games it was, it kind of took some of the edge off. Although I think Saki Mahmood and Owen Morgan would have been much happier if they'd found the odd Yorker in that time and kind of, you know, put it to bed by a bigger margin.
Yeah, it was the first ever one-sided one-run win. Just on a couple of England players have had a couple of good games. I think one of them is Liam Livingstone, who hasn't actually played at all. I just think it's quite interesting that England have chosen to replace him with Liam Dawson, that they replace him with a bowling all-round. It kind of shows how important he is to England's T20 side at the moment. But also, I thought Rhys Topley was really good last night. Obviously, the run-out was amazing. The flick with his right hand to dislodge the bails. Probably didn't have enough time to actually pick the ball up. But with the ball, I thought he was really sharp, hitting the high 80s, got the new ball to swing, nailed his Yorkers, kept his cool at the end, and he conceded just 8 off that penultimate over, which in the end was actually pivotal.
Yeah, it was huge. I think he's a fantastic bowler. You know, again, in the Caribbean, sort of having tall guys is very important in long form and short form cricket. Pitches tend to react a lot more when the ball comes down from a great height. the swing that he got with a new ball and the length he bowled and the attacking option that he gave Owen Morgan against the West Indies top order was absolutely pivotal. And, you know, the run out wasn't actually necessary because it would have been out LBW. Wouldn't it? It was, it hit him on the boot before before Shea Hope got the bat down on it, and he would have been absolutely stone dead LBW. So his analysis would have looked even better had it not been for had it not been for the run out. So yeah, he had a fantastic night. And again, you know, if you're looking for Owen Morgan's always looking for sort of incremental positives. One was the way that they managed to make 170 batting first. 64 for two, they were at halfway. And so they went kind of nuts in the second half. And it could have been more. Then Rashid and Moeen Ali were sensational. I mean, they've got the Indian sign over the West Indies batting, haven't they? And you know, that kind of was what won them the game in the chase. And you're right, Rhys Topley was quite brilliant.
Mm. And then West Indies, they nearly won it. Akhil Hussain and Romario Shepherd putting together the highest ninth wicket stand in a T20I between two full member nations. What do you think went wrong from England at the end? Death bowling has been a problem for a little bit. And I know that Owen Morgan said at the end of the game that it is the hardest job in T20 cricket, but I think England are probably worse than most of their competitors at this moment.
Yeah. It was a little bit painful to watch, wasn't it? You know, Chris Jordan had ended up with an over left. And whether or not that was, you know, that was Owen going, okay, Saki, it's time for you to show us what you can do. We know about CJ. Let's see Saki and have a go. But you know, I asked him the question there in the post match presentation. You know, where were the Yorkers? And he said, to be honest, we were trying to bowl them. We just couldn't. Just kept missing. And that's a huge concern. And again, if you're always asking your batting side, and this partly feeds into the whole thing about batting first for teams, but particularly for England, if you're always asking your batting side to score maybe 15 to 25 more runs than par because you're not that happy about the way that you're going to be able to bowl at the death, you're going to come a cropper every once in a while, aren't you? You can't always score more runs than the pitch is allowing you to get. So harsh lesson, I suppose. And I guess, again, it's one of those things where it's good that that's happened early on in a five-match series. They can, you know, have a real good chat about it, really focus on it again in training. I'm sure they do anyway. But it drives it home. It drives home the point that you're kind of never safe in T20 cricket. And the West Indies lower order, the youngsters there, my God, that hitting was unbelievable from Akhil Hussain and Romario Shepherd. Odine Smith is somebody that you think, well, you know, if anybody can hit six sixes and over, it's going to be him. He's just a complete nutcase with massive pair of shoulders and in a bat speed to die for. So, you know, if West Indies top order can give themselves a little bit of a foothold in games, then they're going to be a very dangerous team.
Mm. There are probably a lot of English fans watching yesterday being like, Tom Curran's gone the distance for a long time for England in T20 cricket to death. Chris Jordan's gone the distance for a long time for England in T20 cricket to death. Saki Mahmood had a bit of a nightmare yesterday. But you watch a lot of T20 cricket, you watch a lot of the 100. Are there other guys out there, or are those three of the best five England have? Obviously, you've got Archer and Mills, who are currently injured.
Yeah, I mean, those two, the two you mentioned that aren't playing would obviously help the problem out, wouldn't they? You know, he was the first person I thought of yesterday was Tamar Mills. You know, you've got lower order players sort of setting themselves to hit big, you know, left arm, 90 miles an hour with back of the hand. Slower balls, you're thinking that's not quite so straightforward. But yeah, it is a bit of a problem. I mean, there's one thing: if the Yorker doesn't go in, or if you can't get that Yorker to go in, and it's very difficult, granted, then you're sort of thinking to yourself, well, I mean, what else can the bowlers and the captain do? You know, the odd bumper. You know, you are allowed to bowl a bouncer. At least put something in the mind of the batsman that the ball is not always going to be in the kill zone. You know, it's not always going to be length or thereabouts. I think, you know, England were, the ball ended up just in the same place. Ball after ball after ball after ball. And these guys set themselves baseball style and just nail it out of the park. So again, if you you're not always going to be able to get the Yorker in, but I'm pretty sure that you can be a little bit less predictable in terms of what you do, you know, bowling those last couple of overs. And sometimes the batters are going to tag you. That's a given. But I think it was a little too easy for the West Indies at the back end, notwithstanding the fact that the hitting was absolutely out as well.
Cheers, Butch. Chat to you next week. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
Well, there's two, actually. Talia McGrath was a name that I'd only recently come to, and indeed quite a few people following the women's game knew of her from 2017 when she briefly featured in Australia's T20 side, but she'd kind of gone under the radar until returning a few months ago and making some waves against India in the autumn. She came into the first T20 I against England, not really sure where she was going to bat, at Adelaide, her home ground. And she put in one of the all-time great individual T20 performances. Elise Perry was on the bench, controversially. But it wasn't so controversial by the end of the game, because you saw that Australia have unearthed another real serious talent. She's 26 years old, and she bowls kind of useful medium pace, heavy balls. She's kind of strapping, tall, strong. She bowls heavy ball, medium pace, first change, and she came out at number three, batting alongside Meg Lanning, and just hit a superb 90-odd, 91 not out it was, to knock off England's target of 170 and a few more with embarrassing ease, really. And it was interesting from an English perspective that they put together a decent score. It could have been more, actually. Danny Wyatt was playing very well up top, and they were probably in a position to maybe even push on to 180, 185. But even with 171, I think it was, Australia just cruised it, really, and it was largely down to McGrath. She was absolutely brilliant, immensely strong through the offside, you know, stayed hit, she paced her innings, and it got to a point where England just didn't have a clue what to do anymore, and everything they tried just went the distance, really. And it was the first of three T20 games between the two, but it's the only game that's been completed because the rains have come, and unfortunately, with the test match in Canberra due to kick off Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, there's more rain around for that four-day game, which again throws into question the logic of women's cricket, women's first-class test match cricket played over 4 days when the game is a little bit slower than the men's. You know, the run rates are slower, and with a bit of rain around, it does beg the question, after four consecutive draws between the two teams and a large percentage of test matches, women's test matches, being draws anyway, it does beg the question why there isn't that fifth day. But maybe we can come back to that in a bit. And my other one, and I'd already given you that one this morning before I saw the rousing
news. Yeah.
The rousing news that my boy Murray Erasmus, who I'd just like to, I'd like him to come round for supper and we'll have a chat about life, love and the universe. And he was made, for the third time, the ICC's Umpire of the Year in their awards at the end of the year. And quite right too. He's an absolute diamond. He had a belter of a home series as well against, obviously South Africa against India. And he managed to kind of find a perfect sort of balance as well between being kind of clubbable and also, of course, being a top-class umpire. He was as shocked by one DRS decision as the Indian side, just actually saying, you know, this is impossible over the microphone. He's got a great kind of avuncular way about him. He gets very, very few decisions wrong.
How do you think they decide that award? Because they have the stats. They know your percentage, but do you reckon it's based purely on that, or is it more what you kind of bring to the game, which obviously he gets bonus points for that in a way that few umpires
I assume it's down to the stats, and maybe captain's reports as well at the end of the game. I think in England, when Michael Gough wins it every year, that's down voted to the numbers. Yeah,
that's the players, yeah.
But back to the Women's Ashes. There's an amazing, amazing stat from Hypo Course, who is an essential follow on Twitter if you follow your women's cricket. So he tweeted, there have been 142 women's test matches played overall. There have been 7 to feature 3 declared innings. There have been 2,433 men's test matches. Only 6 have featured 3 declared innings. So that's arguing in favour of there being 5-day tests. And I guess, like, even if you start with 4 and if there's rain around, I don't really get why you can't do what we had for the World Test Championship final, where you have a reserve day if rain's going to have a big impact. There's a bit of rain in the England-India Test match in the summer. You mentioned Elise Perry not playing. What I thought was quite interesting is that if you looked at the recent numbers, it made complete sense that Perry wouldn't play, but still to actually drop a player who's got that record of succeeding in Ashes matches as well, like her decline actually hasn't been that long. So to be brave enough to still drop someone like Perry is actually kind of quite an alpha move. Shows how strong Australia are at the moment.
Yeah, and I think Matthew Mott got interviewed during the game and spoke about it very clearly in a way that you don't often hear selection decisions explained quite like that. He just said if she's not going to bat in the top order, then her strike rate basically isn't good enough to have a middle order spot. And you know that completely was shown to be the case. I mean, she'll still have a pass, but she'll obviously be crucial in the test match, and she's still, T20s has always been the weaker part of her game. But yeah, their strength is a bit terrifying.
England did look really toothless, I have to say, with the ball. Sarah Glenn went the distance very slow out of the hand, and it felt like the Aussies could you know, camp on the back foot, wait for it. Even decent length deliveries, they were just sitting up and begging on that kind of track. Not a massive amount of pace through the air either with the seamers. And so for all the big talk, it's going to be a very, very, very long tour for them, you fear.
Also, you'd have to say, you'd think T20s were probably England's best chance.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, Australia's ODI record is kind of relentlessly brilliant, isn't it? And they got the better of them in Test cricket recently as well. So you kind of feel like their best chance might have already passed them by. Hopefully not, but...
If they don't win the Test, they'll have to... if the Test is drawn, they'll have to win the ODIs 3-0, won't they, to reclaim the Ashes, which is a very, very tough ask considering that Australia basically never lose ODIs. But yeah, I guess. I mean, but yeah, that first game was just everything that's terrifying about Australia. Women's cricket, right up to Meg Lanning at the end, just ruthlessly denying Talia McGrath that 100. And we couldn't work out which would be more sort of psychologically damaging to England, like that complete remorseless sort of like, we don't care about milestones, we just care about grinding you down, or the fact that she could have easily toyed with England to the point of turning down runs or taking singles when boundaries were on offer to get McGrath to that milestone. But either way, it would have been pretty
tasty. She doesn't do sentiment, I don't think. No. Meg Lanning.
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting as well that not only McGrath, so McGrath, as Phil, you said, she played a little bit of international cricket quite a long time ago, now comes back into the side A26. Alana King, not played international cricket before in Australia, is very comfortable being like, yeah, our players haven't played international cricket. They're good enough to start in Ashes against one of the best sides in the world straight away.
And she changed the game, by the way, yeah. Alana King. You know, brilliant little leggy, came on at a quite crucial juncture with England going well and changed the tempo of the game. Yeah, they just have a conveyor belt of quality, really. And they are the benchmark. The question is just how far down the line are they compared to other teams? And yeah, you always do fear, I think, a little bit for England when they go up against them, especially in their home conditions. It's not over yet by any means, but England needed to register a good result, a good performance, I think, in one of those second or third games. And of course, they were pissed on. So that's that, unfortunately. It's a very, very tough ask from here on in with the rain around and the test match in particular.
One of the bowlers who looked really good for Australia was Tyler Vlaminck, who has since been ruled out of both the rest of the series and the World Cup that's coming up with a recurrence of a stress fracture in her right foot. I thought when she was bowling, it just looks like a different game to when England are bowling.
I saw this morning that Beth Mooney looks like she's going to play the test match. Yeah. She having broken her jaw in the nets 10 days ago. Really? She's kind of patched back up and she's going to play the test match, as if this Aussie team couldn't get any tougher.
Moving on, there was a pretty huge story that emerged this morning. It regards one of the biggest figures in Zimbabwean cricket this century, Brendan Taylor. Taylor's played over 280 times for his country. He scored 17 international hundreds. And this morning he released a statement outlining a fairly shocking sequence of events that has ultimately led to what he describes as a multi-year ban from international cricket that's about to come his way from the ICC. So Taylor claims that in October 2019, he was given $15,000 to attend a meeting in India that was supposedly concerning the launch of a new cricket competition in Zimbabwe. Long story short, after the meeting, he was offered cocaine, which he then took. The next morning, some men stormed into his hotel room and showed Taylor a video of him taking the cocaine the night before and told him that if he did not spot fix international matches for them, the video would then be released to the public. Taylor says that he was then scared for his safety and the safety of his family. and that the whole ordeal had a significant effect on his mental and physical health. 4 months on from the meeting, Taylor, unprompted, reported what happened himself to the ICC. He claims that he never fixed anything, and on his impending ban, he says, "I humbly accept this decision and only hope that my story will be used as a means of encouragement for cricketers to report any approaches early." Joe, that's a really shocking story, and shows that this remains a very real part of our game, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, it's a stunning statement. I was really taken aback reading that this morning. I mean, it's a stunning story on a very personal level, and my main feeling is overwhelming sympathy for the bloke. Obviously, he's made a couple of poor decisions along the way there, but imagine the agony he must have been living through. And, you know, the ICC have rules, and I suppose they have to stick to them, but a multi-year ban feels perhaps a little bit harsh in the circumstances. We'll have to see how long the ban is. But it's also a massive story about just what it means for cricket, and we sort of, I think, try and convince ourselves that this is a problem that's been solved, or is at least in hand, because, you know, you don't want to watch a game that you think isn't as it seems. And it should be emphasised that Taylor is claiming he hasn't actually fixed any games here at all. It never got to that stage. But what this story has shown is really revealed the methods that are being used to kind of trap these players and trap vulnerable players. And Taylor goes on to talk in his statement about the fact that he has a drug problem and that he's going into rehab. So it seems a fair assumption, not 100% sure, but that they've basically done their background research on a bloke who has a problem, and they've targeted him for that specific reason, which is kind of quite a chilling thing to think about, really, that you've got these fixers going to those lengths, doing their research, trapping these players. And also the fact that it only came out because Brendan Taylor seems to have gone to the ICC and reported it. And it reminded me of a chat I had with Ed Hawkins a few years ago, who wrote the book Bookie Gambler Fixer Spy, which is well worth looking into if you're interested in this. And he said that the ICC anti-corruption unit, their heart is in the right place, it's all with the best intentions, but they don't have anywhere near the resources they need to be able to do this job effectively, and they are essentially completely reliant on whistleblowers. And that still to this day seems pretty much the case. I think there have been a few investigations that have shed light on things, but we're still essentially relying on players to come forward, and that obviously begs the question, how much more of this is there out there? Brendan Taylor is not the only cricketer out there with a vulnerability of a drug problem or gambling debt or whatever it might be that puts someone under huge pressure. And we have another example here that there are people around who are desperate to exploit that as much as they can. And it's quite a scary story, really.
Yeah, Taylor touches on like the underlying inequality that makes these stories so much more likely to happen. He says that he wasn't paid for 6 months leading up to the offer to have that meeting. And you think that these fixers probably have done their research. And also what makes me think is like Brendan Taylor is a really big name in international cricket. So you kind of wonder, like, surely it's just not Brendan Taylor being targeted. There are going to be a lot of other players lower down the ladder who are going to be more susceptible to blackmail or bribery, anything like that. And also it's worth clarifying, this is one side of the story that's come out. We don't know the full picture yet.
The ban is interesting. I think the length of the ban, the extent of the ban, and again, you're right, the story is only just coming out and we await the ICC's version of it. He has preempted that official statement that he knew was coming from the ICC. And it may paint a more complex picture in time, but if you take him at his word as it stands and you compare his, as he says, multi-year ban to, say, Shakib Al-Hassan's ban from 2 years ago, year and a half ago.
Yeah, and that was
when he was banned for 1 year. It was 2 years, but 1 year suspended. He was back within a year. And that was failing to disclose various approaches that he'd been subject to and meetings that he had had. That failure to disclose seems to me more grave than Taylor's delayed disclosure to the ICC.
Yeah.
And he makes the point, Taylor, that time is absolutely of the essence, and he understands, having sat through various anti-corruption seminars, that time is of the essence. Of course, you know, if you're going to catch these culprits and so on, then you're going to need the information to be running fast, for sure. And so he holds his hands up on that. But that seems comparatively to be a little bit skewed, Joe.
Yeah, I think so. Look, it is tricky. We don't know all the details yet.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's hard not to take Taylor's statement at face value because it is so honest and so candid. So we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I suppose the ICC might say, look, Taylor has actually got on a flight, gone to this place, met with these people. He acknowledges himself that it seems suspicious. So in that sense, there is action taken, which Shakib seemingly didn't. And they also, they need to come down, I understand the ICC need to come down hard on these players so that people do think twice about doing that. But that old idea that certainly in the Cronier days that people do this because they're greedy, I think we're far beyond that now. It's clear that it's more than greed, and they're canny operators, these fixers, and they'll target people. As you say, the discrepancy between the top and the bottom is just growing more and more in cricket, which makes it more and more an environment that's more likely to suit the needs of the fixers, really. And obviously, on top of that, you've got T20, T10 leagues all around the world, which are ripe for this stuff.
I've not really thought about it before, but hearing you say that the ICC's anti-corruption unit is so reliant on whistleblowers, the idea that a whistleblower gets a multi-year ban for not taking action so early surely deters more whistleblowers. So much is going on through their head, and suddenly if they miss that moment early on, they're like, well, what's really in this for me, to be honest, especially to Taylor towards the end of his career as well.
Yeah, it's a very good point. The bind that the ICC are in, they're headed up by a bloke called Alex Marshall, who's a former policeman, and he's the head of Integrity, I think is the term, general manager of Integrity at the ICC. And I've interviewed him before, and he's very bullish about the job that they've got to do, but also the scale of the job that they have to do, because they have to reverse a culture that had collectively turned a blind eye to this stuff in cricket. And so a zero tolerance policy seemed to be the only logical response to, an uncovered, grim reality that permeated cricket at all kinds of levels, certainly through the 90s, parts of the 90s, turn of the century as well. And they were, and he told me this, you know, he said, I could tell you stories that would chill your bones. And so how do they approach that from a policing perspective now? I understand why the zero tolerance policy, while it may deter certain individuals, the guidelines are there now. You know, the strictures are there now. If you delay, if you have information and you delay presenting that information to us, then we're going to come down hard on you. And I can understand that there needs to be that kind of sternness now. That it's the blight on the game. Of course, everybody knows that. They have at least the ICC in recent years bared their teeth a little bit. There was the Sanath Jayasuriya story, who was a big beast, an icon of the game. Al Hassan as well, again, icon of the game. So they've been accused. I remember Nasser Hussain saying this. They've been accused of going after the minnows in the past. They are at least now beginning to indicate that no name is too big. But yeah, look, as Joe says, this story continues to eat its way into the soul of the game.
But and the solution of the problem is, I mean, like that, it's hard to see there being a proper solution until there is just like a more equitable economy that provides for everyone who plays cricket internationally and professionally, rather than, I mean, because as you say, it's not greed as such. If Brendan Taylor is wanting to just essentially provide for his family, basically, and not been paid in 6 months, that is entirely different to him like seeking out a big pay packet. And basically, you have a situation where there is so much money in gambling on cricket, and that is often more than the players who are actually playing the games that are being bet on are being paid themselves. I mean, I'm actually shocked that until now we haven't had a huge women's cricket fixing scandal, because that's especially where you get the ability to bet on these top level games, and where cricketers are often like even semi-professional at times. And until you get to a stage where cricketers are being basically fairly reimbursed for the revenue that the games they're playing and are generating, then this kind of thing is just not going to go away, because there will be an opportunity to exploit there, and there will be people willing to exploit it, I think.
Back to the England men's side. Just after we recorded last week's pod, a video emerged of Nathan Lyon, Joe Root, James Anderson, Alex Carey and Travis Head being asked to leave a hotel bar by police at 6 a.m. after the Hobart test. The video was reportedly filmed by Graham Thorpe, one of the England assistant coaches out there in Australia, and it's fair to say that the ECB aren't particularly thrilled with that video.
You wouldn't be, would you?
Yeah, allegedly filmed by a member of the England coaching staff, landed in the Australian papers a couple of days later. I don't think there's a huge amount to add there.
That was just the perfect finish to the perfect tour, wasn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. Now's the fun stuff. The four of us have all picked squads for England's upcoming tour to the Caribbean. We're not really gonna debate what England are likely to do. We are picking the squads that we would pick if we were in charge of the England selection process. So let's start. We need a captain for this tour.
So do we all have to get to a point of agreement?
Yeah, we're going to have.
And you have the final say if we can't decide. Is that the?
I'll do it more on what the consensus of the room is rather than making my own decision. Okay.
Thanks for the discussion. Here's the squad I want.
So you're going the Silverwood route rather than the Ed Smith route?
I'm not the chairman of selectors.
Well, I nominated you last night as chairman of selectors.
I'm the one who's putting the list of names down at the end, so I guess I don't know how it actually works, so okay. don't wanna give anyone job titles at the moment. We're gonna have a 17 or 18 man squad, probably 18, just so there's enough cover for all positions. Ben is a firm believer that you need to build squads properly and have cover for every position. So,
and it's worth pointing out that probably COVID allows for that 18th member if we go down that road. Yeah. Normally it would be 16, 17, certainly for a three test series.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Joe, who's captaining for us?
Joe Root if he wants it, and Stuart Broad if he doesn't.
And I think everyone agrees, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've gone round and round with it, but yeah, I think that the paucity of other options makes it. I can't argue against it. And I've received all kinds of grief from friends privately, you know, who are able to just call it as they see it and all
it's
of that.
Quite tasty on your WhatsApps, isn't it?
It has, yeah. I mean, my one of my finest and dearest friends has gone off the top board on this one, and disrespects everything that I say on life, love, and the universe, because I've maintained that I think Root is probably still the best option in the absence of anybody else. But I can understand the arguments against it. I can understand the sense that this is it, that you know, the cycle has come to an end, but not for me.
Would you see it though? How much of Root being captain now is kind of, he's almost like he's gone from being permanent to almost being stopgap, and if a candidate emerges, then you'd be willing to push them up quite quickly. Say someone comes in and looks impressive within, like, say, 10 test time. They've got maybe a couple hundreds. I know we're being very, very optimistic here. But there's a guy who kind of looks that part. Is Joe Root's time up, barring there being another candidate? Or do you think this is kind of the starting of a new cycle under Joe Root?
It's a good question. It's hard to say, though, because historically, England captains tend to resign exhausted and knackered and done in. And they've got no more road left to run. I don't think Root's there. Or he might be now. He might have gone home and reflected and spoken to his wife and so on and decided, sod this for a game of soldiers. But I don't think he's there yet. And I think it's an immense mitigation to make the point that he can't bat for everybody else. And if you can't go north of 150, then a combination of Benno, Brearley, Jardine and all the rest couldn't kind of turn around a series if you can't bat. Now, okay, sure, there are selections that were lamentable and decisions that were regrettable, for sure. No question about that. And he is no great strategist or tactician. But you'd have seen a lot more flair from him as a captain, and you'd have seen a lot more things working his way if he wasn't constantly working against the scoreboard. And I think that has to be considered, right?
We were definitely talking about Root coming into his own as a captain in that series in Sri Lanka, and you know, he's being a bit cannier with his bowling choice and stuff, and that's because they are winning, and that's what it comes down to. And I'm not saying he is a great captain at all, but I think it's so much of it is down to what you've got in front of you. And so who else is going to want the job? And on Ben's point, it's hard to see even any kind of medium-term prospects at the moment. I mean, maybe if Stokes suddenly got back to sort of 2019 levels, you'd think, well, everything's going right. Why don't you just give him the job, possibly? But
he's made it quite clear he's not interested, Stokes. And I don't think that's just being loyal to Root.
No, I don't.
I think
it's consistent with what you said over the last 10 years.
And also, I think when you consider what he's personally gone through with his injury, with his time off to get his head right, as he said himself, and the fact that he is a multi-format player who can be pushed and pulled all over the place.
there's an element of loyalty to Root, but I don't think he is kind of waiting for his time and then going to be dutifully taking it. I genuinely think he's going to think, no, I don't need or want that job.
Yeah. So England can't score many runs. We've kind of established that.
It's been quite a downbeat show. This is just going to take it through the floor.
No, we've got some new names who are going to save England's test cricket.
Exactly. Oh, right, okay.
Ben, who are the openers that you're taking to the West Indies?
Well, so just to sort of kick off, I think that especially compared to what I've heard about Phil's squad, is we have quite different philosophies. As we kind of discussed on a show a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, that I just think it is of paramount importance that England pick the squad that they think is most likely to win this series in the West Indies, which means I've not changed a huge amount. I've sort of tweaked a bit here and there, but I do think they by and large had like the best group of players from county cricket available on that tour. So my openers are...
Did he just gaslight me? Is that what the term is? No. I picked a squad to try and win some cricket.
Okay, fine. But last week you were saying you'd be happy enough to pick the kids and have some fun with it.
No, again, that's just classic media reductivity. It's nonsense.
Okay. Well, this is going well.
Did you see Butch on BT Sport basically criticising your idea for picking the kids?
What, me personally? Did he actually name me?
He didn't name you, but he said, I've heard some people say that England should go out there with some kids. Like, oh, I wonder where I've heard that one before.
But if we go back through it, what I actually said was basically, you know, Butler needs to be taken out of the firing line, and I didn't fancy Bairstow at the time. I still don't really, but his 100 means that he probably does get in the squad. Mm. Aside from that, that was essentially all I'd said. But anyway, you know.
Anyway, Ben, my openers.
So my starting openers would be Zach Crawley and Alex Lees, and I would go for, and this is the one slash I've allowed myself, is Rory Burns and Dom Sibley, because I think from our position we just can't know where each of them are at in their technical overhauls. If Sibley has had a winter in the Edgbaston nets and is sort of back trusting his defence, trusting his leave, I think that there was a very promising test opener there for a reasonable amount of time, and he shouldn't be discarded. Equally, if Burns has had, you know, we've seen him turn around poor bits of form and poor kind of technical periods quite quickly, as he did before 2019 Ashes. If he has done that and he can convince England of that, then I would be fine with him getting another go. And I think that those have been the two standout openers in county cricket over a long period of time, so I wouldn't like to see either of them discarded. But yeah, that's who I would go for. And Lees is, I mean, Yaz did a good interview with him on wisdom.com that went up in the past week, and he sounds like he's a guy who thinks a lot about his game, has been through a fair amount. He had a really good start at Yorkshire and was sort of getting praise from Boycott and all the rest as a future England opener. And then had a really tricky 2 years, which he says is down to basically disagreeing, not getting with the management there, which I thought was interesting, and has since gone to Durham, knowing that he thought if he could score runs up there, they would almost count double in a way. And has averaged about 40 since moving to Durham, which is pretty impressive. And he's kind of, it's almost in the Burns mould of not having had one properly standout season yet, but having had quite a lot of seasons of pretty consistent run scoring. So there's quite a lot to like there, even if it's not like the... I mean, there isn't a hugely exciting opener out there that England just aren't picking, because otherwise they would have picked him by now. So that's who I'd go for.
Yeah, I've got Lees in my squad as well. I think basically opening in Test cricket is so hard, and we're looking at the numbers recently. It's openers are averaging the lowest they have done since the 1900s, so literally between 1900 and 1909, is really, really difficult. And I think if England are going to go for someone new, I'd rather it be someone who's a bit more confident in their game, who's got more cricket under their belt, rather than asking another youngster to kind of learn on the job. So I've gone Lees as my new opener.
You have Lees as well, don't you, Joe?
Yeah. So I've got Lees and Bracey. Lees or Bracey to open with Crawley. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure on Lees or Bracey. I think I would maybe lean towards Bracey. I think it's too easy to discard him based on what happened in that New Zealand series, batting a seven, keeping wicket. That shouldn't really be part of the conversation, mm-hmm. I don't think. And up until that point, he was the up-and-coming county top-order batter who deserved a chance. So I would probably still have him just in front of Lees.
Yeah.
Ideally, you'd have some actual warm-up cricket beforehand and make a judgment based on that. But I don't know what they've got in the lead-up to that. Is it just inter-squad stuff?
Yeah. I do think he was harshly discarded after two test matches, performing a role that he doesn't really perform. But I also think he was too hastily promoted as the next man in. He hadn't had like one really good season at Gloucestershire before 2021. And even that was just like pretty good rather than outstanding. Like, he was picked in those England Lions squads off like really not that much.
But did well in those scenarios against the proper England attack in one of those inter-squad games. And he got 100 for the Lions out against Australia A. And if we're talking about bridging that gap between county cricket and test cricket, he seems to have done that in a way that, you know, Alex Lees hadn't had so much of a chance, but he failed twice against Australia A. If we're coming at from almost that county cricket isn't a great indicator of who should get promoted, then Bracey has sort of shown enough outside of county cricket to suggest that he's worth a proper shot, I think.
Yeah, cool. I was pretty close to Bracey. Well, the only thing is that Bracey is more of a number three, right? Whereas Lees is a proper opener. He's done that his whole career. And I think that there, I mean, often with England, there's not a huge amount of difference, but I think there is enough of a difference that, like, that's, I think...
Bracey's opened quite a bit for Gloucester, hasn't he? He's interchanged between opening and
yeah, but Murray, thinking his really good form at the start of last season came at number three.
I think he got 100 up top, didn't he? When I was picking my squad, I did look, did he open enough? I can't remember if he got runs as an opener, to be honest, but he did. It was kind of mixing and matching a bit.
Phil, who are your openers?
Well, if we can have an extra player, then I put Sibley down as my 18th player. And I can understand that. I don't hate that idea. You know, he's made 100 against West Indies as well. He's made an overseas 100 in South Africa. He has his limitations and his quirks. But I can understand where Ben is coming from on that, and I wouldn't have any issue with him being considered. Crawley, for me, should be England's opening bat for the next 5 to 10 games, see how he goes. I know there's also a big case to make him a number three, but I liked the tempo with the way in which he batted in Australia, and not just the 77, but he made a good 36 in the final test match. Could have kicked on there, but I like the rhythm of his game as an opening batsman. And the bolter is Tom Haynes at Sussex, who's young, but this is the philosophical question that we're all asking, and it's a totally fair one, and it might be more sensible overall to look at a player who's gone the journey on their own career, such as Alex Lees or a Sam Robson or somebody like that. I could totally get that. That might be the smartest move, but then the counter argument to that is identify the players with the best techniques, the most solid techniques, and then allow them to develop and grow in at test match level. And Tom Haynes, if you speak to the coaches around the game, then he's a hugely respected young player, and he has big runs as a young lad coming into the professional game. He's the first person to break 1,000 runs last year, opening the batting in England. Or okay, you know, he played against some slightly lesser teams here and there, but he also made good runs against some good teams as well. And it feels premature, but it also feels, why not? And so I would bring him in as one of three options. See how they face up as well. I would let Haseeb, you know, just try and gather his thoughts. I would take Burns out the firing line for now.
And so have you not got Lees or Bracey, or you've got?
So I have Sibley, Crawley, and Haynes as my three options.
I think on the youth policy, it's obviously something we've discussed a fair amount, but England have kind of pursued a youth policy for a reasonable amount of time in terms of the age of players that they've picked, and it hasn't worked. Basically, like, they've hoped that they can identify good players and have them work out for themselves at test cricket,
is the problem the policy or the personnel?
Well, as in the coaching personnel.
And the personnel that are actually selected?
Is it
their age? Is it the idea, the theory is fundamentally wrong? Or is it that the personnel have not been deemed to be good enough in the end?
No, I personally, the main issue actually would have been the lack of coaching and guidance those players have probably received when they've got to that top level that you have. Players who, like, it's fine if you have a guy who's played first class cricket for 10 years and then you tell him to go and play the way he's played his whole career in test cricket, because you might not change a guy hugely then. But if you have a guy who you're picking because you think he's pretty promising and you're basically just like throwing him to the lines without a huge amount of coaching, which is what it seemed has kind of happened and been allowed to happen within the England environment, so I think the conversation is quite different.
Sure,
if you have a different coaching team in place that West Indies tour, which I guess we don't know at this stage, but at the moment, I mean, you have a set of coaches who haven't seemed too willing to sort of take a player and mold them to test cricket. You are just picking players who you think have a tiny bit about them and just saying, go on, you 20 year old, go and like face Shannon Gabriel and see how you get on. And that is like that. So I wouldn't be comfortable with Tom Haynes opening a test match right now, basically, because of that. If there was a different coaching team in place, possibly. I still think it's slightly early for him. It's been has just been one good season, I think, which is yeah.
So if we were doing it on the number of times each player's picked, so Crawley's a shoo-in, everyone's picked him. Alex Lees is a weird one because three of us have picked him, but two have picked him as a reserve. So I don't know if that changes things a little bit.
Get him in as a reserve.
Okay. So Crawley, Lees, and one more.
Who was in yours, Yaz?
For me, it was I had Crawley batting three, personally. So I picked three openers who are different. So I had
one Burns, of whom is Sibley, right?
Yeah, Sibley, Burns, and Lees.
So three of us have Sibley.
I'd lean Sibley over Burns as well, I think. So yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Sibley, Lees, Crawley, is it?
Yep. Sibley, Lees, Crawley up top. Were any of you guys, were you tempted to have Crawley in at three?
You were, Joe. I was tempted. I really ummed and ahed about Milan here, and I'm still not. He's in my squad, but I'm not wholly comfortable with that decision. He obviously started the Ashes really well and tailed off sort of quite dramatically by the end. And, you know, it was not exactly an environment that was fostering success at that point. So I think you can give some mitigation there. And obviously for the final test match, I mean, he had the early birth of his child. That's obviously going to distract you a bit. So I'd definitely give him a... that's the thing that was understandable right at the end there. I think he's been treated not great in the past, and I just feel like he deserves another crack at it, basically. I think he's shown just enough to think, you know, it's partly going on what Ben said, really. Just throwing in more kids, I don't think at this stage is really the way to go, even though it might be tempting. I think there needs to be as much solidity as there possibly can be, given the chaos that surrounds the whole thing. So for me, he would get this tour at three, and then you make a call, given his age, once and for all at the end of that tour. Are we going to stick with him over the summer as our number three, or are we going to say, thanks very much, you carry on playing the T20 stuff, but your test career is done?
I think the other thing with Milan as well is that he was one of the few, and I think apart from Best, the one on the batting side to start the tour in the T20 World Cup and then finish it in the Ashes, which would also have a big impact. And because of his wife being pregnant as well, he couldn't have his family with him over Christmas or over the tour at all. So I think there is a reasonable amount of mitigation there, and you can see that through the scores. But again, I guess you don't know how he is now. And if you were to say, like, look, my wife's just given birth, I would kind of like to have this one off. But I guess he will know as well that if he asks for it off, or if they were to suggest he takes it off, that is probably the end of his test career. So it's a hugely tricky situation for him as well. But yeah, it's
I think Milan's in. I was the only person not to pick him because I had Crawley at three. Kind of looked at Milan.
You didn't have him in your squad?
No, I'd Crawley at three. And basically, I think he's 34, 22 test matches, averaging 27. I think he's done fine considering England had no obvious candidate to bat three when they needed a three last summer, and he's done okay. Is he even a stopgap? I'm not really sure. I think also with Crawley, I'm just still not that convinced that he's a long-term opener. I still basically think he's just a really good white ball player who will have good days out every now and again. Nothing's really changed my mind. He could still be. But him scoring a really good 70 off like only 90 odd balls doesn't make me think yet that he's opener for 5 years or anything like that. So I'd like to see Crawley come in slightly later if possible. But Milan was picked in three of the four squads, so he's in. Root's in all of them. Stokes in all of them. And somebody else is in all of the squads, but I think he is worth talking about a little bit because we haven't actually talked about him that much recently. Is Dan Lawrence?
He's not in my squad.
Is he not? Was he not? Okay, why have you not picked him? That's interesting.
I've not picked him because I want him to be shown a bit more respect. And he's walked around Australia for 2.5 months, and it must be incredibly miserable to see a team unable to score more than 150 and not to be selected in any of those squads. Speaking to people around the press box in Australia, I don't think he was especially close to being picked either. I wouldn't want to put the kid through more of that. Any kid through more of that. And if he were to be on this tour, then he would still be the reserve batsman, probably. I would rather he just goes back to Essex and just enjoys the camaraderie and the buzz of a pre-season and goes and bats for Essex at four and makes 400s by the time of the first test match at home. And then he can become a legitimate part of the conversation again. If England were going to take him and genuinely consider playing him at 5 or 6, then I'd say it's a different story and he would be in my squad. But I just don't think that they're going to at the moment. And I think it's been quite a sullied period. And I feel a bit sorry for him because, as Joe wrote a couple of weeks ago, he's made 4 ducks, but also he's played 4 significant innings in a very short space of time. No one really knows what he stands for. But he's been in a bib. He's been in a fluorescent bib for 3 months. Mm. I wouldn't put him in another one.
So you think it's different now that Bairstow scored that 100?
That 100 changed. Because I wrote my squad for the magazine prior to the Sydney test. And then basically had to change it. I wasn't going to take Bairstow. I thought that was all kind of coming to an end. And I said, Lawrence has got a bat 6. And he deserves a long shot, long run in the side. Or reasonably long as you can afford to find out whether he can do it or not. But you know, when England can't score hundreds and Bairstow gets one, you've got to pick him, really. I wouldn't go as far as Phil to say don't take him. I just think there's so much uncertainty. There's COVID around. It could be an injury in the nets. It's 3 tests, right? They're playing. I still think there's a reasonably decent chance that Lawrence would get a game. So I would take him out there, even though he is probably the next batsman in. Just because, you know, you don't know how these things might turn out, and it could be the making of him. And I'm not sure demoting him further is necessarily going to help at this point. But
so it's quite interesting. It looks like we're going to have a pretty similar top six to yeah. what England had in the Ashes.
Roll on, yeah.
So we're going to have three, four, five, six of Milan, Root, Stokes and Bairstow, which is exactly what it was in the Ashes.
The only thing is, in my squad, I had my imagined team was Lawrence batting at 6 with Bairstow keeping.
I had that as well.
I guess the argument against is that Bairstow's finally, you know, looked like he can do test cricket again, and then all of a sudden you're changing his role, which is what people say you shouldn't be doing to Bairstow, you know, through this whole time. But I think there is an argument that he was at his best as a wicketkeeper batter for a reason. And I think at the time when he was promoted to number 5 with the gloves originally, and then England tried to make him a specialist bat, there was an argument to that in that he had been England's second best batter after Root for a significant amount of time, and that you want to him to be making match defining scores rather than coming in and sort of making contributions from number 7. But I think with that kind of experiment having gone on for quite a long time and not hugely worked, essentially, you can sort of think that maybe he is just like a player who is capable of being a world class even test wicketkeeper batter, but isn't capable of the, like, even the slight added technical requirements of batting at like number 5 or number 6, which is what you want. You really do want your number 6 to be able to get up there at some point, and I think that that is not something that still we have quite even messed up, as brilliant as that 100 was. And I think if you can just have him back down at number 7, which is going to be more in tune with what he does in the white ball game, and can come out and have a bit more license and a bit more license to fail as well, where there's the less of the constant requirement score runs, then I think that is what will suit him and England best. And then you do still have the number 6 slot where you can groove someone a little bit. And I think Lawrence, I guess the tough thing is, again, England will know how he is after 3 months away and that sort of thing. And they might have seen stuff that they didn't like and whatever and that sort of thing. But like, he should have earned that chance after Pope having, you know, performed equivalently to Pope, maybe even better to Pope over the past 12 months or so. I think that Lawrence deserves a shot basically at number 6, as long as there's nothing going on that we don't know about, essentially.
Did anyone pick Pope?
I don't think so.
No, it looks like time to take him out the firing line, I think.
Yeah.
Joe Keeper? Based on what Ben's saying,
yeah, it's interesting. I
made a good case, didn't he?
Yeah, it did make a case. I had folks keeping wicket with Bairstow as my sort of reserve keeper, but batting 6. But there is certainly, if you're thinking runs are the problem, you think a combination of Lawrence and Bairstow are going to score more runs than a combination of either folks and Lawrence or folks and Bairstow. You lose a bit on the wicket keeping, which I know will upset a lot of people. But you know, I know Butler made a few clangs in Australia, but it wasn't the wicket keeping that cost England the Ashes. It was very much the batting. So I think there's some logic in that. I can see that. I think I would probably, I don't know. I mean, I'm taking them all anyway. So I can make a call on the 11 when I get out to the Caribbean. Right?
That's fine. I think we're all taking folks as well. There is room for one other batter, I think. At the moment, we've got Milan, Root, Stokes, Bairstow possibly being a keeper, Lawrence. I think there's room for one more batter. If we're having an 18-man squad, I think it's fine to have one more.
So yeah, I picked Josh Bohannon from Lancashire, who he just feels like the sort of player that should be getting picked, really. A player who is more or less a Red Bull specialist. People around the game say his technique is, and temperament, perhaps most crucially, is well set for Test cricket. His numbers back that up. He plays on his games are on a good pitch at Old Trafford, which, if you're talking about, again, bridging that gap between Test cricket and county cricket, then performances at Old Trafford is probably quite a good indicator for that. And he got a few runs for the Lions against Australia A. I mean, this is an 18-man squad. He's unlikely to get a game, but I think if he's the sort of person that England have identified as someone who in the next 12 to 18 months might get a go, then having him part of the group, feeling comfortable in that environment is no bad thing at all.
Mm. Phil?
Well, there's a lot of logic in having a look at the player without the expectation that he'll be in that first test. So I can get with that. With Bohannon, he's a player who's made a lot from what he's got rather than the other way around, which might be exactly what England need. The counter argument to that is that he might have a ceiling of talent that will come crashing down on him when he plays at international level. But I can totally see Joe's logic there. I'd be comfortable with that. I mean, my flyer was obviously Vince. For all the reasons that I've said 1,000 times. Do I have to go through it again?
No, you don't.
Probably not.
The stat that I keep coming back to with Vince is I find it mad he's never batted six for England in Test cricket.
Because you look at him and you think he's a 5 or 6 kind of game-changing player. Against a ball that is 50 overs old.
Or so 22 on. Overs old.
Or, yeah. Sorry, yeah, 6 overs old.
Ben, what about you?
Yeah, I can see the logic behind both of those. Josh Bohannon, he has the outstanding first-class record in England of a player who hasn't yet been tried in Test cricket. So I think that there's a slightly limited sample size, but it's growing, obviously. I went for Tom Abel, who has a first-class record that doesn't leap off the page. So he averages, 33, 34 for Somerset. But there is a lot that goes into making up that number. He had his first few seasons, which he was balancing alongside his studies. And we've seen with someone like Kieran Carlson the past year, that can have a reasonably big impact on how much you can focus on your cricket over the winter. Just the things you're juggling, that can change things. And then pretty soon after he graduated and became a first choice member or a full-time member of that team, he was made captain, which I don't know if they say it was a mistake in hindsight, but it didn't agree with him. Basically, his form basically dropped off a cliff. He's spoken about being in tears in the team bus on his way to games, wrestling with the decision to drop himself, which he eventually did. And he's come back from that quite a lot stronger, basically. He's also not a player who's made lots of big hundreds, but he has a knack of making the right contribution at the right time for Somerset, which on that pitch down at Taunton and on some of the pitches you get in county cricket in general is something that has been very valuable for him there, but I think can be a valuable trait when taken up to the top level, and that he's had to work out a variety of different situations. He's had to craft his techniques, lots of situations, and he is a player that is good to watch bat as well. Like, I do like watching him compile in innings and get to grips with the challenge of what's facing him and then kind of figure it out. I like Tom Abel as a player and as an option, but he is also a 27-year-old who averages 33, 34. So I can imagine England fans looking at that and being like, what's going on here?
Who's yours?
I'd Joe Clark.
Right, I was going to wonder.
Because kind of what Ben was saying earlier about what you want from a number six being someone who you could potentially see batting higher up years down the line. He had a really frustrating season last season where he averaged high 30s, kept on getting out between 50 and 65, only 100. But in terms of players who I think could become long-term test players, I don't think there are many in the country better than Clark. He's got a lot of first-class hundreds for someone his age. And I completely get your point on Abel, but I just don't think England can keep picking guys who play on these spicy wickets and just... There are good signs there, but that's just so far off what batting in Test cricket is like. There's just not enough there for me to be like, oh, he's a Test cricketer yet.
That's an interesting point, though, because then are we essentially discarding a bunch of players because they play on certain wickets for certain counties?
Our wicket's definitely as bad as sometimes been made out.
Because I guess you've got...
Obviously Taunton probably is, Kent probably is, but I think it is just so different to Test cricket. I mean, you end up being in a position, and don't get me wrong, and I'm going back to Crawley again. Crawley could be a brilliant test cricketer, but he is 20 test matches in his career and he averaged 27. That's not good enough. And yeah, I'm sure that there are green shoots there, but we're very kind to someone. After 20 test matches and you're averaging 27, you should be like, is this guy really good enough?
For England, Ben wanted him dropped after he scored a double century. Yeah,
so. Before as well.
Before and after.
So yeah, I know with Clark, he hasn't scored the massive hundreds in recent years, but he's only 25 and he has shown that he can score the big hundreds. Trent Bridges is one of the harder places to bat in the country. He's got a pretty good record there as well. Better than the like Abel at Somerset or Crawley at
Kent. I was close with Clark.
Yeah. For me, it was between Clark and Vince. And I think Clark, I think there's slightly more there. I mean,
he's probably the most talented player in English, talented batter in English cricket, not to have received a cap at any level.
I'd much rather have a first look at Joe Clark than another look at James Vince at this stage.
Are we going Clark then? Because we didn't have all the other guys we picked, the uncapped guys, were different names.
Of the names that you mentioned that I didn't pick, then yeah, Clark would be top for me.
There is logic to Clark. There is romance to Vince. Ben?
Well, I would actually lean out of all those names, if it wasn't Abel, would be Josh Bohannon personally. Throw something into it, but yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. I guess
if we're looking for talent, untapped talent, is Clark a more intriguing pick than Bohannon?
I think
he has spent, I mean, he's also spent the last few weeks smacking it around in the Big Bash. I know.
Is there you go.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No idea.
I don't know.
Yeah, what I would say is with Bohannon, if he makes our squad, he's probably not playing the first test match, right? And I think we'll know a lot more about Bohannon after the first stint of another season. He's had one good season, one very good season, and a few like good mini seasons. How he does over the first 6-7 weeks of the 2022 summer, I think will go quite a long way to knowing where he is in England pads. I mean, if he's averaging 45 after 7 games this season, he's probably batting 3 for England in the first test match of the summer. But I think his career is kind of that.
I'm willing to give up Bohannon for Joe Clark in the spirit of compromise.
Cool. And also, cool. Moving on. We've got Folks and Bairstow with the gloves. Quicks are broadly the same as most of the guys who went to Australia. A couple of new names. Phil, you went for Sam Cook and Sakeem Mahmood.
Yeah, Sam Cook is a hobby horse of mine, but I've seen him a lot. I think he's brilliant. I know he's not got real pace, which is obviously the big issue against him as an international bowler, but what he does have is unbelievable relentless accuracy and skill. And his record, his average is better than all of the really interesting medium fast bowlers in English cricket, from Ollie Robinson to Overton and upwards. His record is the best of them all. He's won some pots as well with Essex. He just doesn't bowl bad balls. He's a real talent, but he's not a talent that jumps off the page. Or rather, he's not a talent that jumps off the pitch when you watch him. But Test cricket is based around control. And he would offer England that. Whether he would offer enough incision is the other question. But I think for him to not at least be looked at some point, I think that would be a mistake. It was interesting that he didn't make the Lions squad initially and then they called him up. So he's known to them. If he doesn't play international cricket next summer, then he'll take 75 championship wickets. And I'll tell you that now. His stamina is excellent as well. And this has become a more interesting question as well, watching how England's bowlers have struggled a little. And obviously the Ollie Robinson thing has been drawn into focus, this question. He bowls all day long, and I've seen him do this. He's a good athlete. He's a natural athlete.
Do you think in terms of if he does get a chance, is this the best place for it to happen, though, in the Caribbean? Where, I mean, we just had Butch saying to Yaz, you know, height is so important in your bowlers there.
Well, he's got a bit. He's not a like 5'11", kiss the surface kind of bowler. He's not that kind of bowler, from what I've seen. He doesn't bowl heavy balls as such, but he bowls irritating lengths. It might not be the right place for him, but again, in the spirit of trying to have a look at these individuals, I mean, how much will Joe Root know Sam Cook? How much will Joe Root know Joe Clark? They're all ships passing in the night with cricket as fractured as it is now. So
I don't have any issue with...
And that's how Ollie Robinson's sort of status got elevated from suddenly being in the nets with those guys rather than just being Ollie Robinson who plays for Sussex and takes 60 wickets a season.
Yeah, suddenly, that's a good point.
And just very briefly on Mahmood, as you asked, I think reverse swing in West Indies is always useful. A bit of pace through the air. I think he would feature in a test match if he were out there. And as we've seen, you know, pace through the air has been problematic for England for a while now. And he does have a bit of pace. He doesn't have express pace, to be honest, but he has a bit. I think he will feature in a Red Bull squad before too long. Why not this one?
Yeah, I was the only person not to pick Mahmood, actually. I kept the pace bowlers exactly the same as went to Australia. I kept Craig Overton because England got a problem with people who could bat eight. And also, I think Overton at home is going to be quite important over the next few years. And I think Overton should probably play quite a lot of test matches at home. I know that's a very boring selection. I don't think he will play in West Indies. But if I was looking for a reserve player, I just kind of like the bowler did fine in Australia, keep the same.
Overton is still only like, he'd need two people to be out to play at home, wouldn't he, at the moment? Unless England are playing four quicks, I suppose. But even then, he'd need one person to be out. So he's going to play what, one or two tests a summer, isn't he?
Well, I mean, Anderson and Broad aren't young.
That's true.
Yeah. And I think he has overtaken Sam Curran, and Sam Curran has played a fair few test matches over the last few years at home.
Yeah.
So who did you drop to make room for your two?
So I didn't take Chris Wokes. Okay. And I didn't take Craig Overton.
Okay, yeah.
The thing for me with Sam Cook, and I guess it's just hard to know this because I can't remember having seen him on a game with a speed camera, but there is sort of like a bit of a gap often between how players in county cricket are perceived and actually how quick they are. I think it was interesting seeing Craig Overton compared to Scott Boland in this context, where Craig Overton was the guy they said, this is the best bowler in county cricket. He's pretty quick. He's quick enough. And people say roughly the same things about Boland and Craig Overton. Boland is like 5 miles an hour quicker on average, maybe a bit more. And then you'd get guys like Martin Anderson, who plays Middlesex, and people who watch Middlesex a lot will say, this guy's pretty sharp. And you actually watch him when they have a game with the speed gun and he's bowling 78, 79 miles an hour. And then you get guys like Ethan Bamber, who are sort of like, why could he not be England's Mohammed Abbas, say? And actually he's bowling like 71, 72 miles an hour, whereas Abbas is actually high 70s, like touching 80 at times. If Sam Cook is the same pace or even a touch slower than Mohammed Abbas, I would be kind of fine with having a look at him. But if he is actually mid 70s to low 70s, then that would be like a concern.
He's not as slow as that.
But that's the thing, like if it depends, because you assume that no one in county cricket is quite that slow, but actually there is like a decent chunk of them that are, I think.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. But then he played a couple of games in the 100 as well, and his numbers were okay.
Okay.
You know, they're around the 80 mark.
Okay, well, there's a decent argument, yeah.
Yeah, Ollie Robinson has taken test wickets in various different conditions, bowling around that kind of pace. The problem with him is obviously sustaining it. And so it's a really interesting battle. Obviously, England need more quick bowlers, for sure.
Yeah.
But there are other ways to take test wickets. And we are seeing that, for sure. Probably the least of our concerns when it comes to England is which battery of quicks, so-called seamers,
yeah,
do they put on the park?
Yeah, I think we might as well move on because we all pretty much said the same with the seamers. What one name I'll mention, I didn't pick in my squad, but if I was picking another one, I'd then go Liam Norwell. He had a really good summer, slightly taller. I think he bowls a bit like Scott Boland, and he got 5 for against Australia A as well. Mm-hmm. So
Bryden asked if he'd been fit. I looked at him. He got himself injured in November, but he would have been on that Lions tour. He would have been involved in that. He's an interesting bowler. He is sharp through the air, bit of pace, bit of height as well.
Moving on to the spinners. Ben, who have you gone for?
So I've gone for Jack Leach and Matt Parkinson, and sort of in Phil's vein, do I need to talk about Matt Parkinson again? I guess the one thing is that we still don't know whether or not he is the best spinner in England, basically. And at some point, I think they are just going to have to give him a go and see how he gets on and see if those, like, if he is just a weird outlier in terms of having a brilliant record bowling in the county championship in England and is still somehow not a spinner who can take wickets at an international level, or if that is just a good indicator, and if lots of stuff that you can see is a good indicator that he is actually a bowler who has the ability to take wickets of top class batters in like a variety of conditions. And I think that there is a reasonable chance that he is that, and I think England should find out at some point, basically. Even if he is like a bit slower than normal spinner, you like that could easily be that that's what allows him, I think, to get so much action on the ball, and like that you do see how that like how that fools batters basically. Like, it can be a good thing to be an outlier in a variety of different ways, and that's what he is, and I don't think we'll know until we try, basically.
So you, because I picked both Leach and Parkinson as well, but are you saying you would have Parkinson as your spinner for the first test? Oh, I mean, they picked two for the first test, Arsenal, didn't they? Had Moeen and Rashid, which didn't work out very well.
No.
I'd be happy to leave that to the to Chris and Joe on the ground, because we're the selectors, we don't pick the 11. But I think there's becoming more and more of a case.
Responsibilities. Well, very authentic.
Well, so you do.
One of us is the coach.
Mm.
One of us is coaching.
Because that's the new system.
That's the way it works.
It's not me. I've not played test cricket.
Because I think, yeah, as I said, I would Leach and Parkinson, but I would still start the series with Leach as my spinner. I think he's just never let England down when the ball is turning, and I expect it to in the Caribbean. And I don't think what we saw in the Ashes should mean that he has lost his spot. I thought, you know, that was as much poor management as it was poor bowling, really. Probably more poor management than more poor bowling.
Yeah.
I would start with Leach as well. He would be my premier spinner going into it. I picked Parkinson M, and I also picked Parkinson C.
Got three spinners.
Parkinson C is a one-day spinner by trade, but he's becoming a more than useful red ball spinner. He took 50 wickets, Joe, last year.
Yeah. And bowls lots and lots of overs. That's the thing. Right. He's used to doing it in a way that almost
exactly
no
that.
One else is.
And this is what this is why I popped him in there. So certainly, first of all, in the West Indies, you know, they can be quite sort of crabby pitches, and finger spinners can be quite useful out there. I wanted them to have a look at him. What struck me, Taha made a brilliant point about Leach after Brisbane, and he said, don't often think it, but maybe he could benefit from playing a little bit more white ball cricket. So you have a few more options when someone's coming at you. Well, Callum Parkinson's made his name as a left arm orthodox spinner, trying to keep control of a cricket match. And he did well in the 100 for Stokes' team, the Superchargers, and he's done very well for Leicestershire with the white ball. So that kind of combination of an emerging red ball spinner with a white ball history, I think that's quite an interesting option for England, potentially. Now, I don't know how good he is. I don't know if he comes up against test match players, and he might just be milked, as you see. You see it with Leach as well. But the fact that he has such a good white ball record suggests that he'll back himself to land it when where he needs to, and that is so much of the battle in test cricket. It's not really about how dramatically you're going to rag one past the outside edge. It's not really about that. It's about how much control you can exert. And I just thought three spinners in the West Indies sort of makes sense. Two of them are left-armers, admittedly. But yeah, I threw him in there as another outlier.
I think though we're going to have to go Leach and Parkinson M, just with two, given that's what most of us went for. So our final 18-man squad is Zach Crawley, Dom Sibley, Alex Lees, Darren Millan, Joe Root, Ben Stokes, Dan Lawrence, Joe Clark, Johnny Bairstow, Ben Foulkes, Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, Mark Wood, Ollie Robinson, Saqib Mahmood, Chris Wokes, Jack Leach, and Matt Parkinson. Yeah, pretty happy with that. We had one question that's quite interesting from Poli. He asked, Adil Rashid has 10 first-class hundreds over 500 first-class wickets, of higher first-class batting average than Zach Crawley. Why aren't England bowling a test, building a test bowling attack around him? I guess his shoulder, right?
He's
played so little first class cricket over such a long period of time.
Also, when did he last score a first class 100? He was a genuine all rounder when he first came through, but he just hasn't batted in red ball cricket, had a proper season for ages. I think that is a little bit of a red herring.
You never got the sense he enjoyed playing red ball cricket either.
Yeah.
I think he's at ease in the white ball game. He knows that his legacy's assured. I don't think he has the kind of character to go and own a test match bowling attack. I don't think he has the willpower to come back into it. And how many more times can we go back to him and say, oh, go on?
But it will be one
Rash,
of the...
Just give us another one.
It will be one of the great what-ifs. If you think, kind of, I don't know, people who fall for cricket in 20 years' time, and you look at Rashid's record and you see he's a World Cup winner and you look at his test record and you're like, well, what happened there? Mm. And we won't really have a clear answer.
Did well in his only home summer as well.
Yeah.
Now time for something slightly different. Joining me over Zoom is Duncan Stone, the author of Different Class, The Untold Story of English Cricket. Duncan, it's great to have you on. There's not really a book out there like it. So you look at the history of the recreational game in this country, the underlying class divide that has long existed within it. Can you tell us, first of all, why did you write this book? And to you, what is the book about?
The reason I wrote the book is, as you say, nobody had ever done it before. And the main subject matter only really became to my came to my attention when I was at university. So I did first a master's in sociology of sport, and then after a sort of 7-year hiatus, I then developed what I did for my dissertation at Leicester, which was a comparative study of the regional cricket identities of Yorkshire and Surrey. And obviously, how did two completely different regional identities develop around the same game in different parts of the country? And then I did a PhD in history at Huddersfield, which concentrated on the on Surrey and the home counties and how and why they that region developed an image of friendly or non-competitive cricket. Thereafter, it was an itch I had to scratch, and I've spent the last sort of about 13 years expanding that research into a broader social and cultural history of cricket in England as a whole. But obviously, I would argue it's not like a regular cricket history, which is obviously top down. Not only is do I look at the game from the bottom up, I think it actually is a very good way that, you know, through the lens of cricket, a very good way of actually looking at the social and cultural history of this country as a whole.
Mm. I think it's fair to describe it as quite a punchy book at times. You criticise the reporting, for example, of Neville Cardus. You call him the game's most foremost propagandist, I think, in the opening chapter. As you say, you've done something that hasn't really been done before. So after all these years of research, kind of what are your main takeaways, without giving too much away, about the history of recreational cricket and the underlying class divide that is within it?
Right. It's the million-dollar question. So personally, what I take away in a broader sort of context is that the social upper classes of this country detest meritocracy, and what they want out of suppressing meritocracy, obviously, is the maintenance of their own power. What we witnessed in Surrey and the home counties was the banning of meritocratic competition, and that is where the friendly, non-competitive image of the recreational game in the South emerged. So that is something that I think is warrants much broader attention and knowledge. And then I think in more, and again, I think using sport as a way of viewing how this country actually works and operates. And I think cricket is very revealing in that. And I think it would have a broad appeal, not just to people who closely follow cricket, but social history and culture in this country more generally.
Mm. As I told you before we start recording, I'm really enjoying it so far. And I think one thing that's blindingly obvious is your enthusiasm for the game. You're not looking at it, obviously you are looking at it from a historical point of view, but it's clear that you love the game, you love playing it. I love your descriptions of your teammates. Was it Fairlands Cricket Club? I think a lot of the descriptions of your teammates will resonate with listeners and their teammates around the country as well. I mean, I've got to ask you, the accessibility of English cricket has been in the limelight more than usual in the last few weeks after England's latest overseas Ashes debacle. There's been a lot of focus on how many of the England team are privately educated and what that figure compares to not only past English teams from previous decades, but also just the national divide. Does your book shed some more light on some of those issues behind that problem? Do you have any opinions on that?
Yes, I think it's chronic. It's a chronic problem, not just for cricket, but I would say British society as a whole. many British institutions, such as cricket, have always, and I mean always, been run in the interest of a small minority of people, and that is, regret to say, white middle-class men. Now, the image of cricket, particularly English cricket, reflects that. You know, it's a posh sport, you know, much like rugby union is seen as a posh or middle-class sport. And I actually think that the accessibility problem, as badly as the and disingenuously as the game's been run and presented to the public, I think socio-political changes over the last 40 years have actually made that worse. And I talk about this in the book, about how civil society has been hollowed out over the last 40 years. And that has had a very direct effect on the participation in cricket. So the attacks on trade unionism, and you had obviously privatisation of certain businesses, or the wholesale selling off or closure, deindustrialisation, meant the end of workplace sport. And workplace cricket was one of the most vibrant realms of cricket in the country. And in terms of more recent revelations pertaining to Azim Rafiq, it was arguably the most successful, if you can call it, experiment in race relations. Workplace sport nationwide, but most likely cricket, was the most successful multiracial enterprise in the country. But by the late 1990s, that was all gone. Factoring, obviously, the sale of more than 10,000 state school playing fields since 1981 up until 1997. Obviously, we've sold an awful lot more since then. It's a perfect storm as far as working class access to the game is concerned. Multiracial access more broadly. But as much as race and racism is a very serious problem in cricket at all levels, I do conclude that social class is the underlying problem of all of these things that we're all up in arms about at the moment.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So I think a lot of people listening to this who play regular club cricket will have experienced many games where you have one side that is predominantly white against a side that is predominantly from Asian backgrounds. I mean, you know more about this stuff than anyone else. What do you think English cricket can do? First of all, do you think that is necessarily a problem in 2022? And two, if you think it is, what do you think can be done about it?
I think the main problem is the lack of open. What football did correctly from 1871 is that, and then subsequently the formation, so that 1871 is the FA Cup, and then obviously you had the Football League thereafter, was the organisation of football in a open, socially open, meritocratic pyramid. That is something that cricket has never been organised in any shape or form, in an open way. The county championship, from the get-go, was run in the interests of the counties and its members. The general public as a whole barely got a look in, and it's been a closed shop ever since. Now, if you know, when nobody has to sort of look over their shoulder, then there's no sort of motivation for really pursuing any kind of excellence. Or at least broadening your horizons as far as recruitment policy is concerned. So for the last 150 years, you know, English cricket has not been organized in an open meritocratic fashion. And that goes for the lower recreational game as well. So if you want things to change, you've got to start opening doors for talented outsiders. And there's lots of obviously talented South Asian teams out there, but because they invariably rely upon municipal grounds or even artificial wickets, it's immediately a door in their face.
Hmm.
So you have these structural barriers, irrespective of collective and individual racism, which clearly is out there. A lot of these people who are racist, and many who aren't, seem to want to preserve the status quo. They don't want anyone to be rocking the boat. They've got a cozy little world that has existed undisturbed for many, many generations, and they don't want that upset. So they hide behind these structural, they may not have been put in place specifically to do this, but that is the effect, like it or not. It is a ready-made excuse for keeping certain people out of the mainstream of English cricket. And then, of course, more recently, the last couple of days, we've had, you know, a few ex-players barely aching about how much it's costing their kids to go through a problem when at least they can afford that sort of money. Again, working class people, parents, you know, if they're a one car family, you know, that's bad enough. If both parents are working, which is very much the norm these days, you know, not like when I was a kid and basically mum worked part time, but not, you know, full time. There is no time and no spare income for driving kids to very expensive county trials here, there and everywhere. So there's an awful lot of talent going to waste. And I think the very first thing that should be done, you can argue the toss about how you went about it, but it's opening the doors to competition once again. You know, much like I talked about in the early stages of the book, when cup and league competition was first introduced, that, and not a few iconic amateurs in the long run at Lord's, that is what made cricket a national game. And it's what made football the people's game. Now, if we want cricket to have any kind of healthy, vibrant future, we need to be a people's game. And not something exclusively for, you know, white, middle-class, privately educated chaps. As lovely as they all are, I'm sure.
Mm. Well, very well put. I mean, I've got, you mentioned in at the start of the book who this book is dedicated to. And you say it's for the people who truly have the best interests of cricket at heart. That is who the book is dedicated for. And I think, just to reiterate that, I think I've really, really enjoyed it so far. And Duncan, it's been great having you on the podcast. And listeners, if you're interested in buying the book, head to repeaterbooks.com and we'll leave a link in the description of this episode. Cheers again, Duncan. Thanks for your time. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is some county cricket. We've had a few bits of county cricket news come through over the last week or so. I don't know if you're going to touch on them, but we've Otis Gibson become head coach at Yorkshire, which is big news. And Vikram Solanki has left his role as head coach at Surrey. So that's a big roll up for grabs there. But mine were two overseas signings at Somerset, who, well, it's usually about a month from now, I'm tipping them for the county championship. But I've gone early. Signed up Peter Siddle and Matt Renshaw. Obviously Australian seamer, Australian opener. They're going to be around, I think, Siddle until early August, Renshaw until late August. Renshaw's available for Red Bull cricket and 50 over comp, and Siddle's available for the whole lot. They've also got Marchand de Lange as another overseas. They've got three overseas players to fit into two spots, which is quite interesting. It shows, I guess, that Somerset must be doing okay financially to be able to kind of take. And they're desperate for silverware, and they had such a good start last year. They topped their group, and then when they got into Division One, they lost all four of their games. Their batting just absolutely fell to pieces. It hadn't been great all season, but it just kind of completely disappeared without trace. Renshaw, when he was there in 2018, scored three tons, averaged 50 for the year. If you get a top order batter doing that in county cricket, well, you're well on your way to having a good season, because, as we know, very few of them do it. So I think it's interesting. I think that side looks well balanced. They've got a good thing going at the club. So this is obviously finally the year.
Elsewhere, South Africa beat India 3-0 in Virat Kohli's first ODI series since losing the captaincy. Ben, India's balance wasn't quite right without Jadeja. Venkatesh Iyer has been picked as an all-rounder, but his bowling probably isn't good enough to bank more than the odd over here and there. And then in the end, they went for the bowling all-rounders to bat seven, and they actually did pretty well. Deepak Chahar almost pulled off an incredible run chase at the end to get them a consolation win there. But yeah, it didn't really quite work out for India.
No, I guess, because, I mean, they've had this game plan that has been based around their top three getting loads and loads of runs, and then their bowlers being good enough to defend them. Their bowlers are probably like a little bit just down on form and just kind of like not quite at that level that they have been at, and it's the same in their top three, and that does actually weaken them a reasonable amount. I guess with a game plan like England's, you can almost carry a couple players in poor form because you are counting on that whole kind of top seven to get you up to the really big total that you're going for. So you actually, if you have a guy, and also England's players fail in a way, so slightly less damaging ways, like Kara Hall got a bit of criticism, I think, in the second game for making quite a slow half century, and Rishabh Pant bailed them out with like a very quick 80 odd. He played really well, actually. That is one positive for India. But in England, you wouldn't exactly get someone scratching around to a score in that same way. They would probably just throw the wicket away quite quickly, which obviously, as you saw in the first T20, I can be quite damaging. But so, yeah, I mean, India have quite a bit to think probably, because even their spinners were out bowled by South Africa's spinners. And so thinking that going to a home World Cup, that actually it doesn't matter too much how their quicks are going, because they can just pick three brilliant spinners and they will have wicket takers in there. Actually, even that doesn't look quite as certain as it would have done. So yeah,
Ashwin didn't have a great series in his first ODI series in 5 years, I think.
Yeah, so there is quite a lot for them to consider. But yeah, and I guess it's how much do they try and sort of rip up the rule book a year out from a World Cup? Do they sort of say, okay, we're going to pick a guy like Prithvi Shaw at the top of the order who has license to sort of try and get us off to a flyer and sort of pick guys like that through the middle as well? Or do they think, no, we're going to keep going with three solid guys who will make hundreds regularly, who can get us up to 300, 320, pretty like 80% of the time, and we back our bowlers to defend that. I don't know. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning the South African batters had a really good series as well. De Kock, player of the match in the last two games, scored his 17th ODI ton in the finale, and there were hundreds for Bavuma and van der Dusen early in the series as well. Joe, elsewhere, Australia are now top of the world test ranking despite not having played an away test match in years. What do you make of that?
Oh, it's a travesty. No, I can't bring myself to get too upset about it, really.
It just sums it up on a macro level. If you don't play, you're a better player.
Yeah, I don't think there's a huge amount to choose between them, New Zealand and India. I'd back any of them to win their home test series and then, you know, probably lose as many as they win away from home. That's how it's played out. But I do think that they do seem like quite a clear top three, I would have said, although I suppose South Africa's just turned over India, so maybe they have to be considered in that bracket as well. It's certainly been fantastic month or so for South African cricket, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get to I guess we'll learn a lot more about Australia in the next year or so with their away series in Asia.
The story isn't so much that Australia have gone to number one despite not playing a test match away from home so long. It's how has it managed to be that Australia haven't played a test match away from home in so long, and it has been because of that. Like they are increasingly as a board and as a sort of cricketing economy willing to just like sort of cut out all the games which they think won't make them money, and you see that with some of the games that they have chosen to cancel, and then the lengths they have gone to get the games at home against England and India on does speak a large amount about where their priorities lie, which doesn't say great things about the health of the game globally. I mean, globally, like it's not something that Australia by themselves do. Like you do get other teams putting out of series that they think they can afford to get rid of. And
I mean, England haven't been.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's basically the focus of Adam Collins' column for our latest issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. And he said, look, he's been as critical as anyone about Australia picking and choosing the tours that suit them and their treatment of Bangladesh, who they cancelled Bangladesh tour without even giving a press release a few years back. But he said he sees kind of reason to be optimistic around Cricket Australia now. They've got an Asian triple header. Pakistan series should be a belt. That should be a really, really good series. And then India, and I think they've got Sri Lanka as well. And Nick Hockley, the CEO of Cricket Australia, is kind of making the right noises. He acknowledged that Australia needed to do more for the benefit of world cricket as a whole. So Adam wasn't saying all hail Cricket Australia, everything's great, but he was saying that there are better things being said coming out of the organisation, and let's just see how they go over the next year. And they are going to Pakistan. That seems quite clear, barring anything unfortunate. And Usman Khawaja has talked really passionately about the importance of those tours, saying that Pakistan fans have never seen Steve Smith or Dave Warner in the flesh. What an experience. And you're boosting the game as a whole and Pakistan. So maybe this is the start of a new under Cummins. You know, you've got the nice captain. Perhaps suddenly Cricket Australia is an organisation that is a bit more open-minded, a bit more global, perhaps.
Mm. And finally, or not quite finally, but in Australia, it's worth mentioning how Gloucester's Ian Cobain's doing. He's having a brilliant BBL after being called up late. He's 34 years old, not played a huge amount of overseas cricket, and he's been player of the match in two of his five games so far, including the Strikers' most recent knockout game. There are two more matches to go in a very, very long BBL season. I saw Sam Billings of the day basically say, I love the tournament, but it's just too long, which I think everyone can agree with there. Ben, to finish off, your moment of the week.
Oh, my moment of the week is from the Bangladesh Premier League.
Obviously.
And an amazing, almost unprecedented sort of run out of Andre Russell, where he was batting. I can't remember who he was batting with, actually. But he sort of plays it sort of deftly into the just behind square on the offside for a single, runs through. It's clearly worried about his partner, so he's looking over his shoulder as the ball hits the stumps at the striker's end, sort of skews off and comes straight down the pitch and hits the stumps at the non-striker's end, and he's run out by a reasonable margin. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's kind of thing you'd think you'd never seen before, but apparently, according to Robelinda 2, it did happen in a 1976 ODI. I don't think there was actually an actual run out in that situation, but you did have the ball cannon off one set of stumps into the other. And this did make me look up the run out law in the laws of cricket. And I think technically, if a batter plays a shot and their bat breaks as they play the shot, a fielder can pick up the bit of bat that's broken. And if the batters go for a single, they can run them out with that bit of bat rather than the ball. I think if you look at the laws on what constitutes the wicket being legally put down, you can do it with a bit of broken bat. Like, it so that allows for, if a batter breaks their bat and the bat comes into the stumps, then it knocks the bails off, they'll be out in that situation. But because of that, and because to run something out you have to legally put the wicket down by the action of a fielder, the fielder could pick up the bit of bat and knock the bails off and do them that way.
If you triple check this, are you 100% sure that's a law?
I'd really like to be corrected.
I think we should set this as a challenge to any club cricketers as well. If you can pull this off and also get it given as out in a game this summer, that'd be some going.
We should definitely do it. We've been looking up a few of cricket's more obscure laws for a thing on wisdom.com that's coming up soon.
We should just because Ben enjoys it as well.
Yeah, that's true. We should definitely do a segment on the pod on cricket's strangest laws, because there are a few really strange ones that I don't think many people will know about. Anyway, well done for making it to the end. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisdom Cricket Weekly Podcast. We will be back next week.